You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We're ready to begin. I'm E.J. Dionne, a senior fellow here at Brookings. I moderate a lot of panels. I always say that the greatest insult ever directed to me was from David Brooks, who said, "My eyes light up at the words panel discussion." Isn't that a powerful insult? And normally, even when I have strong views, I try to be, to coin a phrase, fair and balanced about things. I just want to confess right up front, I'm not fair and balanced here because of my feelings about Norm and Tom. Norm and Tom are two of my favorite people in the world, and I cannot tell you how excited I am that they have become celebrities. And I think it's a great thing for them. It's a great thing for the Republic. And I'm just honored to be here with them and with Susan and Mickey, who have agreed to join this great discussion. I want to begin by saying that this event is being live webcast. Attendees are encouraged to live tweet the event, the hashtag. I've never gotten to say that before. Hashtag even worse is where you should send your comments. And books will be available for purchase and autographs at the conclusion of the event. Are there any other announcements I need to make? I think we can just go straight into the main event. Tom Mann is a senior fellow here at Brookings. He is the W. Averill Harriman Chair. He was head of the Governmental Studies Program. He got his BA in Political Science from the University of Florida and his MA and PhD from the University of Michigan. So he speaks for the heartland of our great country. He actually grew up
and he saved the automobile industry.
Right. And he was opposed to their stopping production of the Edsel. He lectures frequently, as all of you know, and is on every radio and television show known to humankind. And he and Norm have often competed for the most quotations in any given year in all of our media. Norm is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's an election analyst for CBS. He writes a column for Roll Call. He has written for every publication on the face of the earth. He and Tom both have often been on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Nightline, Charlie Rose. He has another heartlander, a BA, magna cum laude, from the University of Minnesota, and an MA and PhD from, yes, the University of Michigan, which is where you guys met.
Yes.
I just have to say that one of the reasons why I think that Tom and Norm got so much attention for that Outlook piece is because they have been spending their entire lives being so damn moderate and reasonable that when they get mad, there really must be something wrong. And so why don't I go to Tom and Norm first, and then I will introduce Susan and Mickey Edwards. Tom, it's a great honor to be your colleague.
EJ, thank you so much. And Susan and Mickey, I really appreciate your coming and all of you for participating in this event. Norm and I have been friends and colleagues and collaborators for over 40 years. I know it shows on me. It doesn't show on him, but people often ask me when we collaborate, you know, well, what's the division of labor? Finally, I got a book cover that pretty much lays it out. I mean, you see the subtitle, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. On the left is your Constitution beige, right? You know, slightly worn. On the right is that harsh color implying extremism. Man's on the side of the Constitution. Ornstein is with the politics of extremism. So just so you have this straight.
I've divided base already.
I also want to announce that this will be our last public appearance before entering a witness protection program. maybe we should have followed the full script of Hans Christian Andersen and enlisted a child to blurt out the emperor wears no clothes, but we weren't smart enough to do that. Actually, what I want to say is the response to the the first 10 days or so of or less commentary, I learned what it means to go viral. It was a very instructive lesson from Norm's son. But it's been very heartening. Maybe 5% sort of really ugly hate mail, another 5% sort of constructive criticism, and 90% thank you guys for saying this. And prominent among the scores of people who emailed us and were in the 90% are self-identified Republicans, ordinary citizens and some elected officials and party activists as well, and a fair number of reporters, both of whom take a little heat from us in this volume. And I'm actually really, really heartened by it. I think it's fair to say, too, that we feel each passing day brings more reinforcements of the argument we make in this book. The latest, of course, was Richard Lugar's defeat yesterday in Indiana. Sort of not so much the fact that an 80-year-old man who'd served, what, seven terms in the Senate?
Six.
Was running for the seventh term, lost his election. These things happen, but it was the nature of the case against him that he had collaborated with the enemy when the enemy was in the Senate. That would be Barack Obama, that he voted for Supreme Court justices nominated by Obama, that he supported President Bush's TARP program. It really is quite telling to see how his opponent undermined him by saying that he's gone over to the dark side. It tells us a lot about the problematics of our politics right now. Then we had that incident on the campaign trail. I think it was yesterday when in a town hall meeting setting, a woman got up and talked about the abuse of the Constitution by the president and allowed us how he should be tried for treason. Well, people make sharp statements. I remember John McCain reacting to a statement like that in 2008 and really just drawing the line and saying what kind of a person Mr. Obama was. In this case, you know, Mitt Romney just passed it by. It wasn't the sentiments are so strong, you don't want to confront or engage that. He said, when asked by a reporter later, to be true, it's that, no, of course not. But it's not good. Third, the House Republican Budget Committee is now proceeding to do two things. One is to insist on lower overall discretionary spending than was agreed to in the law that came at the end of that dreadful process of holding the debt ceiling hostage. So unilaterally, they declared that a floor for cuts and not a ceiling. And now, as a way of avoiding the sequestration of the defense budget, have proposed a really remarkable set of additional cutbacks and means-tested programs of one sort or another. I even saw the calmest and most lucid and analytic of reporters, David Rogers of Politico, show his emotion in the course of writing about that. And, of course, we had yesterday a successful Republican filibuster on the Senate Democratic plan for setting, extending a lower student loan rate and financing it in a particular way. That's no surprise. I noted in New York Times that this is the 21st successful Republican filibuster in this Congress. Now, most of it is not sort of, if you will, consequential as the filibuster was in the first 2 years, because There is a Republican House in any case, and Democratic wishes from the White House and the Senate aren't likely to be realized. But the fact that it's been so commonplace and is taken for granted, and in most press reports, the word filibuster never is elevated to the story itself because it's so routine. It's a procedural motion. It didn't get the 60 votes it it needed. It shows you how much the filibuster has become so routine. Listen, our argument is can be summarized briefly. One, we have a mismatch now, a serious mismatch between our political parties, which are highly polarized, internally unified, hyper-strategic in their partisan behavior in Congress that is parliamentary-like, relentlessly oppositional when they are out of government, out of the presidency, but they're operating not in a parliamentary system where that kind of behavior can be quite useful and productive, but in a separation of power system with routine filibusters, with midterm elections, with the possibility of divided party government that, frankly, is such a mismatch that it doesn't work now. The second point, the one that has gotten the most attention, is that the polarization that exists between our parties is not symmetric. There is one party that has really gone off the tracks, that has become an insurgent that is more ideologically extreme, that rejects several generations of economic and social policy, stretching back as far as a century ago, that is scornful of compromise down to the level of the individual Republican identifier who doesn't have much use for facts, for evidence, for science, and perhaps most important of all, that really questions the legitimacy of the opposition party and the extent to which they are real Americans. This is something, you know, we've had individuals say, but never has it seemed to be accepted by the leadership of one of our two major parties. The third point we make is that in the end, you never fix these things without the public stepping up and reining in parties that have gone amiss. But alas, the complications of accountability in our system, number one, and number two, the way in which these events and arguments and battles are portrayed to the public through not the partisan press, which has its own awful aspects, but through the mainstream press by respected, able, highly professional reporters, that leads to a kind of phony balance, a false equivalence of they both do it, you know, they're both implicated. That, we argue, has the effect of demobilizing and disarming a public that might otherwise be in a position to do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. And now I turn to Norm. When they first described this book to me, I said this book is just like that Eric Clapton album that was imitated many times. It was Tom and Norm Unplugged. And so I give you Norm Unplugged.
Thank you, EJ. I actually want to start with a plug. This is not the only book which should be capturing deep attention by those who care about our political system. EJ has a book coming out, which is marvelous, called Our Divided Political Heart. What's the subtitle, EJ?
The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And now you know why I love these guys.
And I suggested a new subtitle, Richard Lugar is the DNBN Foo.
Thank you, Norm.
But please, buy them both, and both make great holiday gifts.
Mother's July 4th?
Day. Yes. Mother's Day. Mother's Day is coming up. Father's Day follows. It's lots of things. You know, EJ started by talking about the 40-plus year partnership that Tom and I have had. And over that period of time, we have tried very scrupulously to be fair-minded and not take sides. Call them as we see them. But it, for me, it's always been a point of pride that I could go and give a talk to people and have some come up afterwards and say, we couldn't tell from that what side you're on. So 40 years we have done that, and writing this book was not an easy thing to do because that's going to change some. There are going to be some people who now see us, see me in particular, as having taken sides. So I often get asked, why did you do this? And I think the fact is, for both of us, we've spent 40 years building some capital and a reputation, and there comes a point where you feel you need to use that capital because the stakes are too high, the consequences are too great. And we both believe that we are at a really critical point in this political system. We face huge problems in the country, short-term and long-term. And if we are going to leech this system of problem solvers and end up with people who say things like Richard Murdoch, the new Republican nominee for the Senate in Indiana, said yesterday, which is, my idea of compromise is when they move to accept my position. If that's how we're going to be faced with making policy decisions that are going to be very tough and painful for Americans, as all major changes in social policy, whether they expand government or contract government, do, they disrupt people's lives almost by definition. And you can't make that work and create a sense of legitimacy in a system where people face short-term pain for the promise that it will improve their lives or the lives of their children in the future. If we get rid of people like Richard Lugar in this process and emerge with people who have a very different perspective. And the fact that we have gone through a number of years where we've been moving in that direction and that people are not held accountable, there hasn't been a price to pay for obstruction's sake, for hostage-taking, and for a lot of other bad behaviors in politics, motivated us not just to write this book, but also to take on a press corps that we think has, to a much greater degree than it should, fallen back into a comfortable position of saying, we report both sides. And I frankly think part of this is because we've seen the emergence over the last 20 years of fairly substantial and effective lobbies on both sides that may have started with accuracy in media, it moved to fair. Journalists, like most of us, don't like criticism. In fact, maybe more than most of us, journalists don't like criticism. And in particular, a mainstream press that has for many years been hit with the idea that it's a liberal press, to be hit hard from the right with the idea that you're tilting in that direction brings about a desire to overbalance. And in this case, it's an overbalance where the value becomes, as we've heard from many reporters, our obligation is to report both sides of the story. And my response to that is, all right, so if you have a hit-and-run driver, do you say that when the hit-and-run driver comes out and says, hey, it's his fault, he stepped into the crosswalk, that has equivalence with the victim? And that's not the obligation of journalism. It's to report the truth. And in this case, we have decided to report what we believe is the truth right now. And that truth reflects not a brief for one party. I have no desire to carry water for the Democratic Party. And I have no desire to simply turn the Republicans into a version of the Democratic Party. We need two vibrant parties that have different centers of gravity and that compete with a lot of vigor and bumping heads together, but also have an understanding of the nature of our political process. It's different from a parliamentary system. It is a system where if you are going to reach a level where people in this extended republic accept those decisions that are made, you've got to find some broad bipartisan leadership consensus. And that means collaboration. It doesn't mean, here's what we're going to do, and if you want to come to us, that's fine. If you don't, screw you. It doesn't mean we're going to obstruct because that's the way for us to get ahead, even if it brings significant damage to the country along the way. we got to shed some blood during the course of a revolution. It means something different. Our political heroes include people like Barbara Conable, to whom we dedicated, along with Pat Moynihan, our book several years ago, The Broken Branch. It includes people like Dick Lugar. It includes people who have been very strong conservatives. If you read Lugar's statement after his defeat, which reflected some considerable degree of bitterness, but also was a very eloquent statement about what we need in our political process. And this was not a statement coming from a guy who said, hey, look, I'm just your everyday moderate. In fact, he said, people often said to me during the course of this campaign, why don't you just become an independent? And he said, I'm a Republican. I've always been one. I always will be one. I believe in the values of small government, less taxes, and all the things that reflect what conservatism was and presumably ought to be. But that's not enough now. And Jack Danforth said today, partly, of course, in reaction to Lugar's defeat, if we continue to move towards purity, we will move to irrelevancy. And along the way, the country, in effect, is going to go down the tubes. And that, I think, is a clarion call. And if you get clarion calls coming from people like Chuck Hagel and Alan Simpson and Dick Lugar and Jack Danforth, and not just from us, that ought to shake people up about where we are and where we're going. And what we hope would happen, but has happened actually with a degree of penetration that astounded us from the Washington Post piece before the book, was that all that credibility that we had built up would get out there and resonate with people, that this isn't just a couple of people coming from one end of the spectrum saying it's all the fault of people at the other end. And this is not 100% the fault of one party. There's plenty of blame to go around in a lot of ways. But this really is the case of a system that has grown in dysfunction as one party has become, as we say, an insurgent outlier. And it needs not to disappear. It needs not to become so pure that it moves to irrelevancy. It needs to move back to where it was when we had a system that had plenty of imperfections, but that worked to solve short and long-term problems by finding ways to create legitimacy behind the tough decisions that we'd make.
Thank you very, very much, Norm. Just two things I want to say before I introduce Susan. The first is one of Norm's great lines that I've heard as they've been talking about this book is, if you want to understand the book, understand we believe Democrats move from, say, the 40-yard line to the 25-yard line, but the other guys have moved to some point outside the stadium altogether. And that is
Anacostia,
kind of useful.
I think it was, the river.
And the other is, apropos of journalists, a politician once said, look, we politicians may have thin skins, you journalists have no skins, which I've always tried to keep in mind. And so it is an act of both great graciousness and bravery that Susan Page has kindly agreed to join us today. Susan is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, where she writes about the White House and national politics. She's won a slew of awards, the Gerald Ford Prize for Distinguished Reporting on the Presidency, the Merriman Smith Memorial Award for Deadline Reporting on the Presidency, the Aldo Beckman Award for Coverage of the Presidency, and a whole lot of other awards. She is a regular guest host of the Diane Rehm Show on NPR. She's been on PBS, MSNBC, CNN, and many other broadcast outlets. A native of Wichita, Kansas, she received her bachelor's degree from Northwestern and master's in journalism from Columbia, where she was a Pulitzer Fellow. And she'll be followed by Mickey Edwards, who is a lecturer at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy and International Affairs. He was a Republican member of Congress from Oklahoma for 16 years. He was a member of the Republican leadership. He served on the Budget and Appropriations Committees. He's taught, in addition to teaching at Princeton, he's taught at Harvard and Georgetown. He's shared various task forces for the Constitution Project for us here at Brookings, for the Council on Foreign Relations. He is currently vice president and director of the Aspen Institute's public leadership program. And his latest book, The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans, will be published by Yale University Press this summer. And I promise that before you leave, Mickey will baptize all of you as Americans. But first, I want to turn to Susan Page.
Thank you. Thank you, EJ. It's a great pleasure to be here with four people for whom I have so much admiration and who I have quoted so many times in so many stories. I have, I think, a little bit of news, which is I have found out the title of the next book that is coming out between Tom Mann and Norman Stein. You can figure it out from the path of the previous books. 1992 book by the two of them, Renewing Congress, sounds pretty positive. 2000, The Permanent Campaign. Okay, maybe not entirely positive, but at least pretty neutral. 6 years later, 2006, The Broken Branch. Okay, sounds a little perilous. Now, it's even worse than it looks. Their new book is Run for Your Lives. After that, they're just going to be marching up and down here in sackcloth, holding a sign saying "End Despair."
That's a good title.
Let me. they take on many institutions in Washington and elsewhere, and let me just talk for a minute about some of the things they say about the news media, which is appropriate to criticize. There's a lot to criticize about how we do our jobs and how we ought to do them better. And they talk about fact-checked institutions. That's something that I think journalism is doing more of, things like truth-telling on TV ads. That's one thing I think a lot of organizations, including my own, is trying to do this year. I think there's been some move in the last few years to do what you just talked about, Norm, which is if someone says something is black and someone says it's white and you can tell that it's white, you shouldn't just say he said it's white and he said it's black. And the two things that I think of, two specific storylines that have pushed journalists to be more willing to call someone as saying the truth or not is the whole birther movement. Because we found early on in the Obama campaign 4 years ago that it was not enough to say, this voter I interviewed said that he was born in Kenya. Obama denies being born in Kenya. You know, that did not tell readers fully enough what the truth was. And so I think you'll see the mainstream media when this comes up, and it continues to come up a lot of times, I have to say. You say so-and-so said he was born in Kenya. However, he was not born in Kenya. He was born in Hawaii. You go on and state as fact what we believe to be true, which is that he was born in Hawaii. The other thing that I think has pushed journalism in the direction that you want them to go is climate change, because there was a time when I think a lot of news outlets would report climate change skeptics with kind of equal force with people arguing for climate change. And now I think when you see reports on this in the mainstream press, they're much more, like I say, the overwhelming predominance of scientific opinion is in favor of climate change or in believing in climate change. The one thing, there would be nothing in this book to fault exactly, but the one thing I think might get kind of underestimated in this book is the degree to which this paralysis is a conscious choice by a whole group of voters. You know, if you look at the criticism that Richard Lugar made of Richard Murdoch and Murdoch's defense of himself, it's the same thing. Lugar said he doesn't want to legislate. Murdoch said, I don't want to legislate. Lugar said he won't make the compromises necessary to get things done. Murdoch said, that's exactly what I want to do. If you elect me, I'm going to throw sands in the gears of government. I'm going to prevent things from getting done. I don't agree with the consensus that has governed Washington for so long. I'm presenting a different path. And that was true with the rise of the Tea Party movement in 2010. I mean, voters who voted for Tea Party-backed candidates were not tricked into the kind of tactics that supporters of the Tea Party movement were going to follow once they got to Washington. They said they were willing to take the government to the edge of a cliff on something like the debt ceiling and over the cliff, because they said that was the only way that they could achieve the kind of political ends that they wanted to see. So in the end, it seems to me that the fundamental problem here, or a fundamental problem, is dealing with such a lack of faith in government and such a disconnect from the federal government and such a suspicion about the role of the federal government that it's led a significant portion of Americans to want to elect candidates who do exactly what they said they were going to do, which was stop things from happening in Washington regardless of the consequences.
Thank you so much. I want to correct, that was excellent. I want to correct one thing I said. I said Mickey would baptize you all as Americans. I realize, among others, we are joined, and we appreciate it, by the ambassador from Norway.
You will only be baptized as American if you wish to be in the country. Mickey Edwards.
Well, honorary American.
A green card may be a discretion. Yeah, he's already a citizen of Minnesota.
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say it's a great pleasure to be able to be here with Tom and with Norm. I have been a friend of theirs for a very long time. There are no two political scholars who are more respected and who have more credibility with the American people than Tom and Norm do. And so I'm delighted to have a chance to be here and, you know, help them sell as many books as possible. You're not allowed to leave. We have the doors blocked unless you buy their books. And, of course, I've worked with Susan and with EJ for a long time. And so, you know, I'm very pleased to be able to be here and be part of this. What can I add? First of all, I agree when you talk about it's even worse than it looks. I agree with that completely. It is, if you really examined what is actually happening on the Hill in every conceivable way, how decisions are made about who gets to sit on what committees of jurisdiction, how decisions are made every day in terms of whether or not to allow opposition groups to offer amendments to the process. All of the, if you actually saw this in detail, you'd say it is worse than it looks. It is much worse. I would say there's a couple of things that I would add. They were certainly right in what Tom said at the beginning and Norma said, that the problem is not equal between the two political parties. Some of you know I wrote a book 4 years ago called Reclaiming Conservatism, basically saying that the people who call themselves conservatives today have no idea what real conservatism is. Yeah. And they're preaching some kinds of weird ideas that seem they don't even understand what the Constitution is. So I'm not going to take the role of defending the Republican Party at all. I will say that it may be that this book could do a better job of arguing that there is also fault on the other side. And Nancy Pelosi is a good friend of mine and has been for a long time. But when Barack Obama wanted to reach out and work with Republicans, Nancy said, as you remember, you know, we won the elections, we'll write the bills. When the Democrats were controlling the House, they did what Republicans had done before and what Republicans have done since, which is to use closed rules to prevent amendments from being offered and to shut down debate and consideration of alternatives. So I do not dismiss at all the criticism of the Republican Party, and I agree that the party has become more locked in against compromise, which is the essential ingredient of a nation of 320 million people. It's not consensus, it's compromise. And to shut it off, as the Republican Party has done, is a terrible problem. But let's not let the Democrats off the hook, because they've also been partners in this. And there were just a couple of U.S. House members who lost in their primaries, you know, as part of the Democratic purification process. So what we have here is a system where both parties are focused primarily. That's the reason I have the subtitle of the book, which was written not by me, but by the editor of the Atlantic magazine, you know, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans, is because they're focused on party, focused on party advantage. How do we win the next election? And I have argued that and I think Tom and Norm both have come to grips with this, too. A large part of this problem is systemic. So when you look what happened yesterday in Indiana, Dick Lugar losing, and I think that was a terrible thing that he lost. But when he lost in a Republican primary. When Robert Bennett lost in Utah, he lost in a Republican primary. When Joe Lieberman lost in Connecticut, he lost in a Democratic primary. When Mike Castle lost in Delaware, he lost in a Republican primary. And I don't know what would have happened if Dick Lugar had been able to run among all the voters in Indiana. But we've created a system here in which the parties themselves can prevent the voters, the bulk of the voters in the state, from being able to choose among their options. And you have closed parties that are dominated, you know, by the people who are the most partisan, the most ideological, and that's what moves the process forward. They do that in congressional redistricting. They do it, as I mentioned, in how the parties choose. You know, I think Tom's a great guy. I think Tom's very smart. He probably knows a lot about economics. If he were a member of my party and he wanted to be on the Ways and Means Committee, I'd say, Tom, you're great. You would be perfect on Ways and Means. It would be good for America, and I will put you on the Ways and Means Committee if you promise in advance that you're going to stick with the party line on these three or four things. So I guess what I'm saying is to make this book even better than it is, and it's a superb book, well, it would have to be three times as long. And it's because the problems are not only in the people who are elected and how they behave, but it's the system that allows these people to dominate and become our official decision makers in Washington. So I have been having thrown that in there. I just say that this is a really good book. It's a superb book, and I agree with what Norm said. Given their reputations, which are sterling, it took a lot of courage to write a book like this. I admire them both for doing it.
Thank you.
I'm such a contrarian, I feel like turning on my friends now, but I won't. I won't do that. I can't do that. But here's what I'd like to ask. And then I also, again, I want to remind people that, especially the people who are listening on the webcast, that they can send their thoughts using the hashtag even worse. And I'm going to turn to Christine in a second when she has some comments. Let me start with a question to you, Norm, and a question to Susan. The question to you, Norm, is, I mean, Mickey has really laid out, in a sense, the question that probably lots of people want you to answer, which is, you have really singled out the Republicans. You say they are the insurgent outliers. And then Mickey sort of said, well, but the Democrats have done a lot of things wrong, too. Can you sort of explain why, and Tom as well, if you want to come in on this, but Norm had expressed an interest in answering this question before, you know, that why the Republicans really are different. And then to Susan, and I'll just give you some time to think about it, I'm sympathetic to, I mean, I write an opinionated column, so it's easy for me, but I'm sympathetic to their critique of the press. And here's what really hit me this morning when I was looking at the coverage of Lugar, which is, during this primary, Dick Lugar was regularly described as a moderate. And I looked up Dick Lugar's rating from the American Conservative Union. Dick Lugar's American Conservative Union rating is 77%. Now, if that's moderate, that's a spectrum pretty skewed to the right, because he's already more than three-quarters of the way over to the right. And that struck me, that the very language that reporters use ends up being a concession to a radically changed situation, and it doesn't even acknowledge it. So I'd just like you to sort of think about that. But Norm.
Thanks, EJ. Let me see. I didn't want to say good things about our panelists before they spoke, because it would seem like I was tilting the process. But it's just a thrill to us to have both of these people here. They're role models for us. And Mickey, I could add to that pantheon of heroes. From the time he was serving in Congress, when he was a contrarian, because he stood up for the Constitution and for Article I at a time when his colleagues were trashing it for their own political purposes. So he really is a true conservative, and the kind who we used to have who solve problems. And Susan's the kind of journalist we used to have a lot more of. So having said that, a lot of what Mickey said is true. There are no angels here. And Democrats have manipulated the process, dispensed with the regular order when they felt it was in their interest, particularly during that 40-year period when they were in the majority, and especially towards the end of it, became arrogant, condescending towards the minority, misused the rules, often would use a proxy power in committees have one person show up and throw out every minority amendment, even the good ones, just because they could. So, you know, it's not as if we're looking at angels versus devils, but there really is a difference. And one way to express that difference is if you look at what happened in after 2000. George W. Bush gets elected after the most controversial election, at least in 100 years, 36 days to decide it, a Supreme Court 5-4 decision to put him in, no coattails at all, and in a very weakened position.
And lost the popular vote.
Lost the popular vote.
Just remind people.
And it would have been easy for Democrats to stomp all over him. Right from the beginning, and basically damage a weakened presidency. The first thing, Bush pushed two initiatives when he first got there, No Child Left Behind and tax cuts. No Child Left Behind moved through in a model bipartisan fashion, with the impetus for it coming from George Miller and Ted Kennedy, liberal Democrats. Now, you can say, well, they like that policy. But the fact is that in doing so, they gave legitimacy to Bush and made his presidency stronger. Democratic votes enabled those tax cuts to go through, whether you like them or don't like them. Then we had 9/11 and a rallying by both parties behind a range of legislation, some of which was quite controversial, but almost unanimous support. And then you move on to the TARP program, rejected first by Republicans, and it was Democrats who saved the bacon. Now, I compare that to two things. The first is what happened with a president who came in under not the same circumstances, but without some great momentum or mandate, and that was Bill Clinton in 1993. And the first thing that happens is every Republican votes against his economic plan in both houses, acting like a parliamentary minority, and then a whole series of programs, including the health care plan, where there was a conscious effort to make sure he couldn't get what he wanted. Now, it's also true that he couldn't keep his own Democrats together, and they have some culpability, but a very significant difference. And then you move to 2009. We have a president who's been elected in a landslide with enormous coattails, a clear sign of where the public, what the public wanted, a president who comes in with a 70% approval rating and the worst economy since the Great Depression. 3.5 weeks into his presidency, he has his economic program, the stimulus plan. Now, you can argue, and I think Mickey would, that that was a plan largely hatched in Democratic rooms, but it also had more than a third of it, almost 40%, as tax cuts. And the single largest tax cut was the extension of the alternative minimum tax, which came from Chuck Grassley, who ultimately voted against the plan. 3.5 weeks in, not a single Republican in the House votes for it, and three in the Senate, not including those who had most of their amendments added. And then we move on from there to not a single one voting for any significant initiative. Now, that to me represents a difference, and a difference which suggests a willingness to try and figure out how you can solve some problems, even if there are other places where you want to stomp on the president with jackboots, and Democrats did that with Bush at other times. But a real contrast between where the two parties are now. So there are no angels here, but we really do have one party that is not that far from the midfield area, although it's moved, and the other party that's behind its own goalpost.
Do you disagree with any of what Norm just said, Mickey?
No, I think the problem is with both sides. But as I said, the Republicans are worse. I don't like the goalpost framing, because it depends on who decides where the middle of the field is.
Right.
And so a lot of Republicans would probably say, well, yes, but we've said for 40 years we don't want to go there. And now our failure to go there doesn't mean that we've changed or become bad. But I think the problem that I see, and that really bothers me, and it is, I think it is worse on the Republican side. But we do have, on issue after issue after issue, I can tell you right now, I don't know whether the next nominee for the Supreme Court will be nominated by Barack Obama or by Mitt Romney. I don't know who will get the chance to make that nomination, but I will tell you now, and nobody in this room knows who it will be, but every Democrat, if it's Obama who nominates that person, every Democrat will vote for him or her, and every Republican will vote against him or her, because that's the situation we've got, is that it all comes down to my club against your club. And I think that's our basic problem. Both parties are only playing to the next election. They're playing to their own base, and they're not worrying about solving problems. But I do agree, Republicans have been worse at it, more in lockstep, less willing to engage with issues, more, you know, what Richard Murdoch was saying, that Norm was quoting, is fairly typical, at least of the Republicans who take part in the primaries and do that. I think that's right.
Susan, can you address the question I asked? And I could give other examples, but that one just really struck me, where it seems to me the press is allowing one party to redefine where the middle is without acknowledging that this is a new middle from the middle everybody was accustomed to.
And, you know, I think words matter, so I don't think it's inconsequential whether in reports the Indianapolis Star, for instance, called Lugar a moderate or a conservative, especially in a climate where that was a weapon that was used against him in the Republican primary. Maybe we need to retire for now the word moderate from being used in Washington, because we've got nobody in the middle. As the book points out in the National Journal study of congressional records, there is no Republican with a more liberal voting record than the most conservative Democrat. So now we have literally zero overlap between the two parties. Maybe moderate is not the word we should be using. I think you make a very fair point. Dick Lugar has a conservative voting record. He's got a conservative history of half a century in government as a mayor and then in the Senate. So he's a conservative. But, you know, I think the reason that reporters have called him moderate is not because of his voting record. It's because of his manner. And in this climate, he has a moderate manner in that he's willing to talk to Democrats. He's willing to work with Sam Nunn. He's willing to engage with President Obama on issues. And there are some liberal Democrats who you'd also say are moderate in manner. And so maybe that's the language that we should be more careful to use.
Tom. Can I just follow up on that? I think Susan's right. It's about more than ideology. It really is. And if it would be a mistake to say this is nothing but the ideological polarization of the parties. It also has to do with sort of process of politics and a belief in the legitimacy of the other side and a willingness to engage in real give and take. I mean, Barney Frank got along pretty well with his ranking Republican, Spencer Baucus, but Baucus leveled, you know, once they finished in committee, even though many of his ideas were included, I can't possibly support you on the floor because sort of my party has a strategy. It's a political strategy that I can't do anything about it. But Mickey's right. There is a broad dynamic at work here that affects both parties. There's just no question about it. And we may not play that up enough in the book. We certainly believe it, that there is so much now strategic partisan behavior. It's happening because the parties are operating at a level of parity so that each election there's a chance of a change in party control of the White House and majority control of the House and the Senate. And so there's a kind of relentlessness to think in those strategic terms. And both engage in that. And so in that sense, I'm with Mickey completely. But right now, there's a sort of fundamental difference between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans, partly because of the public and their constituencies, believe that government has suddenly gotten out of hand. It's just too big. It's too expensive. Taxes are too high. And anything associated with government, except for the Defense Department is counterproductive and a bad thing. Democrats, for their part, who once were insurgents themselves, are now a more diverse party, and they're a party that's protective of government to some extent, especially the major elements of the inherited regime, going back to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, continuing through Franklin Roosevelt, and frankly, Richard Nixon, who is responsible for a good part of the domestic policy apparatus of the country. They're realistic now. They are not wild-eyed liberals wanting to socialize activities. I mean, it's a joke. They understand that the demographic forces at work and healthcare cost increases will make programs that they and most Americans think absolutely essential unstable and weakened over time. So they are fully willing to engage in those negotiations. Whenever I see a press report, well, the Republicans say no new taxes and Democrats say don't touch that, our entitlement programs. And I say, which Democrats? Who counts? The president isn't saying it. The leadership of the parties are not saying it. They're perfectly prepared to negotiate. But sort of everyone understands, you know, if you're serious about deficits and debt, you don't begin your program, and as Paul Ryan has, with major new tax cuts, and then imagine how you're going to sort of put that together in the end. And so I think that is a sort of fundamental difference. Democrats are protective, their political incentives are to play the same hardball, permanent campaign hardball, but they're not prepared to put at risk the full faith and credit of the United States. They're not prepared really to shut the government down. They just won't do that because they believe government plays an important role. And I think conservatives, real conservatives, want the government that they have and not a bit more and that they need. But they're not wild and crazy about just dumping on that. And I think we have it's almost a radical perspective, not a conservative perspective, against one that's much more protective of government. And I think that difference is real.
Thank you, Tom. By the way, I just want to throw out a theory which you can keep in the back of your head, and I want to go after to the hashtag even worse caucus, where Christine will tell us have some comments. Just one theory. It's all Bill Clinton's fault. And I would explain that by saying that starting in the 1990s, moderate Republicans began leaving the party in large numbers in places like the collar counties around Philadelphia. And so the John Hines Republicans aren't Republicans anymore, and you've created an entirely different Republican primary electorate. Witness what happened in Delaware or Indiana. I'll just leave that there. Somebody can comment. Christine, thank you.
Thank you. First off, the Twitterverse is loving Norm's pink socks. That's been a fundamental thing trickling up. I have two questions. One is from Robert Kelly, who's a student at American University, and he says, if there's a systemic problem, what changes to the system do the panelists feel are most appropriate? And secondly, Michael McVicker, who's also in Washington, he's a self-described aspiring policy analyst, and he wants to know, are voters getting what they deserve, and when are they going to wake up?
But, Barney Frank, by the way, once told an angry crowd, look, we politicians are no great shakes, but you voters are no day at the beach either. A brave statement. Who wants to, you want to take either or both?
Okay. Well, first, there are systemic problems, and half this book is about what not to do and what to do, but we have to start with an acknowledgement that this is not something that's going to be solved by tinkering with the institutions or even the institutional setup. to some degree, it's a cultural problem now, and that's it's tribal politics. And it's also built into a broader media system. You know, we can talk about the primary electorate, but the fact is that people like Grover Norquist and Rush Limbaugh and cable television networks and other talk radio have an enormous impact here. They both help to shape the zeitgeist and to create conditions where politicians who might otherwise be willing to look for solutions can't, because if they do, they're dead. And when you watch the degree to which political figures give obeisance to these individuals, even when they go wild, and Limbaugh has said some things that are beyond outrageous, you get no pushback. Because whenever you've had a political figure who just tries a little bit to say, gee, that was too much, they get their legs cut off. Now, what do you do when the new world of media basically tell us that the business model that works is the Fox News model, that somehow a network with an audience at any given time of 2.5 million people can make more net profits than all three network news divisions combined with an audience of 30 million people? And
is that true?
Yes. $700 million in net profits for Fox News last year, $1 billion it looks like this year, more than the three network news divisions combined, and CNN and MSNBC. It's enormously successful. And if they abandon that business model, if Fox News tomorrow said, all right, here's the new message from Roger Ailes, can't we all just get along? You know, we may not like what this president wants to do, but he's a good man, and we can probably find ways to work with him. I will guarantee you that within a week, there would be a Wolf News channel that would take the old message and the 2.5 million people at any given time, which is 20 million people through the course of the day, would all gravitate over there. And that's where the money making would be. So it's very hard to change this stuff. How do you create a new public square where you can at least share a common set of facts and then debate hammer and tong over solutions? That's a challenge, and we've discussed that a little bit. At the same time, getting to what Mickey said, we've got to find ways to broaden the electorate. We are both big fans, all three of us, having spent time in Australia, are big fans of the Australian system of mandatory attendance at the polls. I won't get into the details here, but basically a small fine if you don't show up, you don't have to vote, you can vote for none of the above, has led over many decades to 95% plus turnout in Australia. Now, high turnout is not an end in and of itself. The former Soviet Union had 95% turnout. It doesn't reflect health in a political system. Chicago can get to 110% on a good day. But what Australian politicians will tell you is, if you know that your base is going to be there, all of them, their base is going to be there, all of them, you don't focus on energizing and exciting and scaring the crap out of your base or suppressing the other side's base. You have to focus on the voters in the middle. And it changes the issues you talk about. They don't talk a lot in their campaigns about guns or gays. They talk about the economy, jobs, the climate, education, and things that matter. And they don't use the kind of language that we use in our campaigns because you'll scare or turn off the voters in the middle. Absent that, since we don't like mandatory anything here, I've now come to be a champion of a Mega Millions lottery where your prize, your ticket is your vote stub. And if you look at the last Mega Millions where people, you know, camped out 3 days in advance to be able to get a ticket where, of course, let's face it, the chance of winning was less than being struck by lightning twice in a day, you know, put a few hundred million dollars into this and we'll up our turnout significantly. Open primaries, I think, are an easier way to move in that direction. A lot of things that can be done. And we've got to do some changes inside the system, including the filibuster.
Can I add a word?
Please.
I think the two questions really go together. That is, how to make it better, and isn't it the public's fault after all? I think those things fit very well together. If you have a mismatch, if you have ideologically polarized parties operating in a separation of power systems, you can, one, try to alter the parties over time, and that's what Norm's been talking about, ways of moderating parties. And the best way to do it is to expand the electorate as much as possible, because those
who do not now participate are ones with less absolutely committed and polarized views, and you know, a reinforcement for Australia and the dozens of other democracies that have some form of mandatory attendance at the polls. The other thing is, you say, okay, we got these parties. Let's have a political system in which they can get something done. That means fundamental reform of the Senate. I believe the United States Senate is today the most dysfunctional legislative body in the democratic world. The very processes that in the past, and I'm looking out at Senator Sasser here, in the past would lead people to come together across party lines to try to work out some agreement, now do just the opposite. They reinforced the absolute partisan divide between the parties, and individual senators have come to so abuse the individual holes that frankly the sort of the partisanship and the culture is such that the Senate cannot function under its current rules, and that's a big change that's needed. One final thing. Thinking of change and the public. Sure, it's the public's fault. They, you know, they got frustrated and angry because the economy didn't improve, and they changed the team in power after 2 years in 2010 and created a divided party government and a Republican majority that believed it had a public mandate to do just what they said they would do, and they worked hard to do it, and the public hated it. So in a sense, you know, they got what they asked for, if not consciously, unconsciously. But that's, in a sense, that's asking too much of the public. It'd be nice if every member of the public was registered to vote and voted and kind of had the knowledge of a typical attendee at a New England style town meeting. But hey.
At a Brookings seminar, please.
Or a Brookings seminar.
God save the Republic.
It's not going to happen. People are busy. It's hard just keeping life whole without investing in 2 hours of reading of the Times and the Wall Street Journal every day. But it does mean we've got to figure out a way. It's very hard in our constitutional system to make the choices more clear, to hold individuals accountable. Divided party government has become the bane of American democracy now. It worked under other conditions. It doesn't work now.
Thank you. Mickey has some ideas, and I want to bring him back in, but I want to sort of turn to the audience. Do we have some mics to circulate? Oh, well, you've got a lot of hands here. Why don't you come up to the front? I've got four right up here. We'll start with Mr. Mitchell, and you can pass the mic back. Let's take it like three or four at a time, if you could all be brief. Don't necessarily do what we do what we say on this. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Keep it short, you. Garrett. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to ask Tom and Norm about an idea that I think they've been leery about, but I want to try to put it in a different context. And it comes from two recent interesting perspectives, one from the field of technology and business and the other from politics. Bill Bradley, in his latest book, is talking about the possibility of a third party, which is, as he describes it, a congressional party. It has no ambition or interest at this point in the presidency, but that it is beginning to offer alternatives at the congressional level. Related to that, I think, in my judgment, it's related, but I want to test the idea here, is the renowned professor at the Harvard Business School, Clayton Christensen, who's introduced this notion of disruptive innovation, which, as you may know, was Andy Grove said, this guy really understands what's needed. The notion of disruptive innovations is very simply that if you want a disruptive innovation, you come in at the sort of lower end of the market and work your way up instead of trying to come in at the top. When we think about third parties traditionally, we think about them as parties that want to nominate presidential candidates, whereas if you look at Bradley's notion of a coming in at the congressional level only and just beginning, you know, beginning to take a few seats this term and more seats the next term and sort of work your way up the food chain. And if you match that with Christensen's study of what were successful disruptive technologies, and by the way, that includes things like community colleges and their impact on four-year colleges, A, I'm wondering whether you see the linkage between those two ideas, and B, whether you think, given what Bradley is talking about, that it might get at what Mickey's talking about, which is the systemic problems that the system is stuck with.
Thank you. Could you pass right back to the gentleman behind you there? Pass Senator Sasser, Ambassador Sasser.
Mark Bruenberg from Press Associates. I'll be very brief. I'm going to take the subtitle of your book, which is Even Worse. What happens if even worse gets even worse? Where do we wind up? Do we wind up like Greece? Do we wind up with pitchforks in the streets? Or do we wind up looking like, God forbid, a developing country? Or what used to be called a developing country.
Thank you. And then there was one more back there, the gentleman right on the aisle. Thank you. This is a worker self-management audience.
Hi. I'm Fred Altman, and my question is, are the extreme views, particularly of the Republicans, but on both sides, likely to lead to more repressive government?
Well, thank you. Now, I promised Mickey could come in on the ideas for reform questions, so you can answer any of these you want in the context of saying also what you wanted to say before.
Well, the only thing I thought about Garrett's comment about starting at the bottom with the House, you know, some of us don't assume that the executive branch is higher than the legislative branch. You know,
so, here, here.
I think you start with the presidency and try to get a committee chairmanship. I did want to respond to the tweet we had, you know, very quickly, you know, what can be done about it, open primaries, nonpartisan redistricting, a nonpartisan speaker like they have in Great Britain and in Canada, nonpartisan staff like they have in Germany and in many states. There are a lot of solutions that can be implemented, and the ones especially like open primaries and changing the redistricting powers would make rather, that's what happened in California, happened in Washington State. You know, that can be done through the initiative petition. 24 states have initiative petitions in their constitution. It can be done. But I'm taken by the one about whose fault is it. I am now going to sound like Jimmy Carter. It's your fault. And here's why. I've had the chance to be on panels several times with Sandra Day O'Connor and listen to her. And she would say, you know, by you I mean the citizenry generally, by the way, not you. But we don't teach civics. We don't teach critical thinking. If you read Bill Bishop's book, The Big Sword, several years ago, Americans are now divided into self-selected insular groups where their friends are like they are. You only talk to people who think the way you do, who watch the shows that you watch, who read the columnists that you read. This is self-government, and self-government requires a certain kind of engaged citizenry, not only participating by voting, but by participating in serious, honest, thoughtful engagement with the issues, the questions of the day. And too many Americans, you all are here because you do the things you're supposed to do, but too many Americans don't do that, you know, and that's a major part of our problem. We do have a political system that is a result of what the American people are supporting and the way they're living. And in terms of where will it end up, it could end up even far worse than it is now, and I hate to think about that.
One strength of the book, it seems to me, is that it says, number one, there's no silver bullet. There's not one thing you can do. Americans elect is not the solution. A balanced budget, a constitutional amendment is not going to fix things. But also makes a case that it's not hopeless, and that there are a series of pretty achievable steps. I wouldn't put Australia in mandatory voting. You're going to start speaking with an Australian accent soon because you're so enamored of the idea of mandatory voting. It's not going to happen here.
What's wrong with that, mate?
Mandatory voting, move to Sydney.
I'll just put another shrimp on the Barbie then. And
but there are things that some states are doing now and that are achievable that step by step kind of move you back in the other direction. So that is, on a book that sounds pretty apocalyptic, that's actually one of the messages by the time you get to the end of it.
Yeah. Tom, Norm?
Let me talk a little bit about a couple of these. First, what Gary said. I'm skeptical of third parties generally, and of course part of the problem is you can start at the House level. Given the nature of House districts, the ability of a third party to actually win seats, I think, is very, very limited. Maybe over a longer period of time. And I would say, if Jack Danforth is, if Jack Danforth's projections work out, if you do get a party that keeps moving in a direction of purity and moves into permanent minority status or into irrelevancy, and if, let's say, Mitt Romney, who is by no means running as anything other than somebody who represents now what is the core of his party, and it's a measure of how far off the rails we've got, that you've got a presidential candidate who's taken a position on immigration that basically meets with the approval of Russell Pierce and Sheriff Arpaio, and that a candidate like John Huntsman basically gets disqualified from the get-go by saying, you know, maybe scientists have a point. But if Romney loses, I think the conclusion of a good share of that base is going to be, see, we nominated another moderate, to use that right. word we don't want to use, and now it's time to really get the candidate that we want. If that happens, you're going to have a lot of voters who are not going to have a home. And excuse me. At that point, one challenge for the Democratic Party is, can you occupy the middle enough that you will provide a home for substantial numbers of people there in the middle? Or do you decide not to, and then where do they go? And I don't know what happens under those circumstances. In terms of could they get worse, and along with those lines, one of the things that really scares me, and voters being the problem, a comment that Bob Inglis made to me, I don't think he would object to me saying it,
former congressman
this
from
is
South Carolina.
You know, a very conservative guy by normal conservative standards who got rejected in a primary because he, basically two reasons. One, he voted for TARP and tried to keep us from going into free fall. And two, whenever he would go to town meetings and people would push him to say that Barack Obama was a socialist, what Bob Inglis would say is, look, I don't agree with him. I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum. But this is a good American, a good family man, a patriot who's trying to do the right thing, even if his ideas are not ones I believe. That was enough for him. But he said he was talking to a couple of longtime supporters of his, older voters, upstanding citizens, and he gave his little pitch. And they said, Bob, you know, we like you, but we can't support you anymore. You don't understand. What this president wants to do is bring in all those Mexicans over the border so that he can transform America into a Soviet socialist state. And, you know, where do they get these things? They get them from emails being sent to them by their friends and relatives, which have a patina of authenticity and authority to them, even though they're utterly false and loony. We all get them. There isn't a week that goes by when I don't have somebody who's a very smart person send me an email and say, geez, I couldn't believe this. And I would say, there's a reason you couldn't believe it. It's utterly wrong. They say, but I got it sent to me by all these people whom I trust, and it sounds reasonable. How do you combat that? Factcheck.org and PolitiFact can take this on, do it once, and then the email may sort of go
underground.
They
actually have started. They I've forgotten what they call it.
You got to keep doing it because
mother-in-law called
these
me
things
about one
keep
of
coming back. And the problem that we have is that this can create a level of tribalism, where if we hit a real deadlock, then we really have a breach in the country, and it's impossible to heal. Tom and I, among other things, did a long-term project on election reform after 2000. And the fact is we have not cured the problems in the election system at all. And one of the problems is that we're the only country that has partisan election officials. It is insane. It's like having the Caps game tonight with the referees being employees of the New York Rangers. who's going to trust the outcome or when the penalties are called.
But we're the other way around.
Or if we had Vladimir Putin on our team. The fact is, if we have another election like 2000 and we have an evenly divided country, you're not going to have the half of the country that feels it got jobbed by the Supreme Court or by election officials saying, all right, you know, somehow we got to move on. They're going to take to the streets. And what happens after that could lead to repressive measures, or it could lead to a fracturing of the country. And we don't want to go there. We really do not want to go there.
Hey, Tom, can you hold for a sec? I can bring in, you can get the first dibs. By the way, there is a plausible scenario where you get to a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College, and that's when you write the Run for Your Lives book, I think.
From Australia.
Where you will happily compulsively
vote. Which is not far enough away.
Let's have a show of hands. Let me do one more round of several people. I went to the left side of the room, so let me go to the right side or vice versa, depending on your point of view. This gentleman right up front, yes, sir, and then right behind you, sir.
Hello, Lorenzo Morris, Howard University. When you look for an explanation, an external explanation of behavior and the more rigid leaning of the Republican Party, Norman Ornstein said that, well, you all said that it was the voters at some level, but said, referred in particular to the Fox News profitability and the inevitability of money following the more extremist ideas in the media and elsewhere. So the question to me is, to what extent can that link of the money to the media be linked to the greater rigidity of the Republican Party, whether it is in campaign finance or elsewhere? If the public insinuation into the process is one that's facilitated by media guided and influenced by ideologically imbalanced money, is that going to have a greater reflection in the, or has it had a greater reflection in the current condition of the Republican and Democratic parties?
Thank you. That's a great and highly relevant question. The gentleman right behind. By the way, I think the main takeaway from this is, what will The Onion do with the idea of wolf news? I can't wait to see. Please.
Hi, I'm Eliza Newland Carney from CQ Roll Call. Acknowledging that there is a conservative wing of the GOP that has gained influence, is it really fair to say that they represent the party as a whole? That's part one of my question. And two, is it possible that these folks play a valuable role in making it easier for moderates in both parties, including the president, to make the tough decisions about things like entitlements and taxes?
Oh, now there's an optimistic view. Thank you so much. And then right behind you.
I noticed that Mr. Ornstein's pantheon of heroes, he called it, none of them are still in Congress today, or Mr. Lugar won't be in a few months. It seems that once they are on their way out or are out the door, Alan Simpson is a great example, they say all the right things, but when they're in or continuing to run, they don't. Olympia Snow is another great example. What would you suggest that we do as a public or others do to encourage politicians who are in office to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do?
Tom, you can start on, and especially, I'm curious because you've done so much work on that money question.
Yeah.
And then whatever you wanted to say before. And then I guess we're supposed to, are we close or past the time we're supposed to?
No.
Oh, good, good.
No,
I usually go over, so I was assuming I was.
Time. We have many fascinating questions pending, most of which haven't yet been answered. Let me try to run through a couple of them. Eliza, no. The conservative wing is now the party. It's been embraced by the party. Its agenda has been embraced by the leadership. The chairman of the Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, a very able member, is the architect of that agenda, which would make every Tea Partier very happy. So it's indistinguishable. And they in no way provide cover for all those moderates who want to do the right thing. I don't think said people exist in the Republican Party. Listen, the answer is eviscerate Grover Norquist, no new tax pledge. That alone would free the Republican Party to engage in good faith, substantive negotiations. Everybody knows it. Our taxes are now at a historic low in the contemporary era, and they're going to go up sort of naturally. And if with the aging of the population, I guarantee you we'll be somewhere around 23% of GDP. Wouldn't it be nice if we could acknowledge that and say, what's the most sensible, efficient way to structure a tax system? Probably a progressive consumption tax directed in ways to accomplish a whole host of objectives. But as long as you have that pledge to which members sign, it's hopeless. The Republican Party cannot be a player in any constructive resolution of the problems confronting the country. Gary, there is no political space for a third party to occupy. It's based on a presumption we have two extreme parties and there is this great center to mobilize, and I'm deeply skeptical that there's room for such a party, and it would really play a constructive role. Is it going to get worse than it is now instead of just looking worse? And are we en route to the status of Greece? Not at all. I mean, the simple truth is we're almost close to a position where the status quo would solve our problems. That is to say, the expiration of the tax cuts pretty much take care of our immediate and intermediate deficit problem, and implementation of the cost-saving measures strengthened over time in the ACA would deal with our long-term health care problem. So we're not that far away, and we have other tremendous strengths in our country that would allow us to make the kind of investments to transform the economy, to deal with the reality of stagnant wages and a sense of diminished opportunities. We have strengths. We can do it. We need the public to rein in behavior that's destructive, and we need political leaders to act forcefully. We've given enough to bipartisan commissions and searched enough for bipartisan consensus. It's time for sensible hardball politics along these lines.
Norm, I'd particularly like you to take the money question, because yeah. I understand I've forgotten their names. A couple of political scientists had a great chart that showed that party polarization in Congress was directly correlated with increasing concentrations of wealth, increasing inequality went together with
right.
partisan polarization.
The money question you can handle in so many different ways. I am really concerned about a post-Citizens United system with a Federal Election Commission that's completely out of control, and with other agencies unable to do anything about it, and a lot of money coming in ways that intimidate political actors and tilt a policy process in a very bad way, and in a way that will only enhance inequality. And if you look at this one example from North Carolina, where you had a group of agricultural interests who wanted to influence the state legislature on an ag bill, and they prepared a bunch of model commercials that would destroy members of the legislature, put them on the iPad, went in to see them. It had nothing to do with agriculture. It basically defined them as, you know, child molesting aliens out to destroy the fabric of America, and showed them the commercials and said, you know, if we don't get what we want, millions of dollars could be spent on commercials just like this. And they got what they wanted and didn't have to spend any money. That's what this has done. And the idea that this is not corrupting, Anthony Kennedy lives on a different planet in a different universe than the real world of what we face. So there's all of that to deal with, and we're getting model legislation being written basically by outside interests that just gets plugged right in. It's the Gilded Age brought up to the 21st century, and nothing that we want. I want to take a little – I always like to find places where I can take issue with Tom. And so I want to address the question of Eliza's question. I actually don't believe that the right wing that now is out there representing the Republican Party represents the Republican Party. We have survey after survey that shows on a range of issues, self-identified Republicans do not take those same positions. The Tea Party consists of a lot of older voters who have no clue what the Ryan budget would do on entitlement programs that they don't want touched for themselves, just for others. So it's not clear to me that all of this will play out necessarily the way that they want. And I believe there are problem solvers still in Congress. They are completely intimidated from being able to play that role. But you still have a few who have taken out to do so. Mike Crapo, Saxby Chambliss, and Tom Coburn, and not to mention Dick Durbin on the other side, actually stepped out on a limb here. And it'll tell you where we are in tribal politics, that when Barack Obama praised the Gang of Six, an aide to a senior Republican in the Senate immediately sent an email to Politico saying, that kills that plan. If he's for it, we're against it. This is not less about ideology now than it is about tribalism. So that's a challenge that we have, and it's not encouraging moderates or providing space. It's intimidating them. Every time, you know, getting to the question, every time we get people who leave Congress, we get these Republicans who leave, and it's like you've been inside a tent where you're breathing a gas, and suddenly you're outside and you say, how could I have done that? How could I have acted that way? So one of our ideas is to create a shadow Congress that consists of former members who span the spectrum, but who start with a common set of facts and maybe have them debate, not in the way that Congress used to, because Congress never was a great debating society, but genuine debates and discussions that aren't going to have huge audiences, but you can provide a model for how voters who yearn to have some real discussion of what our options are. You can start with the notion that there is something to climate change, and then have a great debate over whether you do anything, whether you do a lot, whether you do it with a carbon tax or do it with a cap and trade program or through some other mechanism that could actually give people a sense of what our tough choices are, instead of having people who say, gee, maybe scientists have something, and then they're thrown out unceremoniously. Small steps that may provide us with some opportunities to change the dialogue.
And just very quickly, we had a USA Today Gallup poll of 12 battleground states that came back on Monday. A third of Republicans, people who said they were Republicans, not leaners, but people who described themselves as members of the Republican Party, when we asked them their ideology, called themselves moderates or liberals. Right. A third of the party. And in this particular poll, for the first time, Republicans lost their enthusiasm advantage in the presidential race. And the reason they did was because declining enthusiasm among that group, moderate and liberal Republicans. So there are no there is not a Republican in Washington who would describe themselves as a moderate or liberal, but a third of Republicans out in the country do.
Yes. And then they lose primaries.
Well, there's that.
Just to Eliza's point, Rahm Emanuel liked to say that the Republican Party is deeply divided between its small government wing and its no government wing. And I do think that is, there is a truth within that barb. I am told we are now at our time. I want Mickey to come back in and a couple of closing comments. Incidentally, the part of this book that hasn't gotten as much attention, and Susan mentioned it, I liked the Bromides We Should Ignore chapter, which I would just read you. The American political system will correct itself. No. Third party, the rescue, they say no. A constitutional balanced budget amendment, they say no. Term limits, they say no. And full public financing of elections, they say no. But then they have a whole bunch of things they say yes to. And I propose that you have your shadow Congress, and then we can have an election between the shadow Congress and the current Congress, and then we can see who wins. So let me invite everybody to do closing comments. Let's start with Mickey.
Well, okay, just going down a couple of these. Does this represent the Republican Party as a whole? As Susan just said, no. But it does represent those who vote in primaries. Yeah. And so, you know, it's a matter of you can't be on the ballot. Every state in the United States except four has a sore loser law, which means if you've lost your primary, you can't appear on the ballot in November. Those need to go. But, I mean, so it's the primary voters who are represented in the party. Secondly, in terms of what can we do about it, you know, I don't know how many of you or how many of your friends, I assume it's all of you, show up at a town meeting, show up where your member of the House or Senate is present. participate in the elections, call into the radio and TV show. In other words, we need to get the citizens engaged. The citizens aren't crazy. 42% of the American people are now registered as independents. You know, they're fleeing from the party, but they need to be at those meetings. They need to confront. They need to be confrontational with their representatives and senators and say, we're not going to vote for you if you behave this way. The final thing, the question about can it become more repressive? You know, I got to testify on behalf of the American Bar Association to a committee in the House when the president, previous president, announced, you know, through his various signing statements that he would decide for himself whether or not he had to obey the laws. And every Republican saw nothing wrong with that. Democracy is not about policy. It's not about policy outcomes. It's about process. And I think as long as we continue to focus on do whatever we need to do to get the policy outcome we want, to hell with process, to hell with the Constitution, you know, is it repressive, more repressive? You know, how do you define repressive? How about wiretapping without a warrant? Is that repressive? I do think we're more on a slippery slope than some people would want to admit.
Susan?
Just briefly saying what an achievement it is to write a policy book about Washington that gets sold out on Amazon. So yeah. Congratulations to our two authors here.
Tom and then Norm.
I want to thank my colleagues, Mickey and Susan, and EJ, of course. We're really with you. It's a very negative-sounding title, but we, too, agree with you that there are things we can do building up, small things that can help produce a larger and more informed electorate, changes we can make that would allow the public to hold officials accountable in a way that's very difficult to do now, that in the end, clear signals from the public and responsible institutional changes, especially within the Senate, and sort of political leaders willing to sort of lay it out not just say we all have to come together, but listen, this is how we must begin and be forceful. There is a bright future for the country. I'm pretty optimistic.
I would just say, finally, a couple of pleas. First, please buy the book. Second, please buy EJ's book. And please buy Mickey's book. And please, Susan, write a book.
Thank you all very much.